This is Building Bridges with Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash.
How President Lincoln used greenbacks to fight the Civil War. So can't we print money and eliminate the debt?
Well, we're going to take a look now, kind of going back in time to go forward in time, if you will. There's a lot of attention that's being paid to President Lincoln right now, since we are in the anniversary of the Emancipation Proclamation. Well, in 1862, President Lincoln signed an act to create a new government-issued paper, greenbacks, not redeemable in gold or other precious metals. His successful experiment helped finance the North to prevail in the Civil War.
So we'll explore with Professor of Law and Public Finance, Timothy Canover, why Lincoln chose this path and the lessons we can learn as our recovery, our economic recovery, is threatened by obsessive concern by both parties about cutting deficits and funding the government.
Now, putting in perspective the debt ceiling and the fiscal cliff. And Tim, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, you're very welcome. My pleasure. Thank you.
Well, I want to start because Ken is much more sophisticated, if you will, about these things than myself. I was reading your article, and, you know, most of us have been schooled in greenbacks. And wait a minute, no matter what, debts have to be paid or things implode and explode and destroy. And that's not quite where you're coming from. So maybe we can begin by this very interesting notion of Lincoln funded the Civil War on greenbacks that really weren't backed by any precious metals. Huh?
Right. Well, it was a significant percentage of the money supply during the early 1860s. I think at its peak, about 43% of the money supply was in the form of greenbacks. And you've got to understand the context, which is, first of all, there was no central bank. There was not even a national currency. The currency that was used were notes that were issued directly by private banks. And at the time that the Civil War began, there was a great need for some funding because the North had, I believe, only about 17,000 soldiers in uniform. And within 2-3 years, I think the Northern Army grew to 900,000 soldiers in uniform. So how do you pay for that kind of a big mobilization of society? Lincoln and his Treasury Secretary, Salmon Chase, first approached bankers from, the bankers were in Philadelphia, New York, and Boston to see about getting a loan. And the terms that they were offered were not very good terms. It was something like, I believe, more than 12% interest that they would be paying for the loans. And the way Lincoln and his Congress responded was to pass 3 legal tender acts, which authorized the Treasury Department to issue currency directly and not to borrow it from anyone. So that was the greenback. Essentially, they were United States notes. They were notes issued by Uncle Sam, and the Treasury Department printed them up and spent them into circulation. That's during that period, it wasn't just the Civil War. The North was also engaged in building a transcontinental railroad. The land grants, colleges were being formed. So there were an awful lot of good works that were being done aside from the war, the necessity of war, that needed to be paid for. And, you know, the criticism of this kind of an approach of using greenbacks is that it could be inflationary. And certainly you could say it's inflationary just to the degree that it actually starts employing people and increasing consumer demand and business demand, and just the laws of supply and demand mean that there will be more demand for goods and services as resources are put to work. But you could say that with any currency. Today, the currency is not issued by Uncle Sam. Instead, it's in the form of Federal Reserve notes, notes that are issued by the Fed, and instead the Treasury is forced to either fund its operations by taxation, what it collects through the Internal Revenue Service, or on the bond markets, what it's able to borrow and pay interest on its borrowing, of course. So one could say, well, you know, as the Federal Reserve increases the money supply, that could be inflationary. It seems to me self-evident that the money supply is going to have to increase at any given time just to keep up with the demands of a growing population, growing businesses. The question is, how much should it increase? And but should we be locked into only one type of a currency, which is a currency that's issued by a privately owned and directed central bank, or should this public option in currency be put on the table that that Lincoln used with the greenback? And I should also mention that when Roosevelt first came to power in early 1933, of course, they were facing even more dire conditions than the economy today. They had mass unemployment, lots of business failures, wave of business failures and bank failures, and importantly, they had falling prices and wages across the board. So they really had a deflationary problem that they had to stop. And Congress passed, I think it was in the Agricultural Adjustment Act of 1933, there was an amendment introduced by Senator Thomas. The Thomas Amendment gave President Roosevelt about a half dozen tools, policy options, to try to stop the deflationary spiral and have a little bit of inflation, or try to inflate a little bit. And one of those policy tools was authorizing the president to issue $3 billion of greenbacks, of United States notes. In the end, Roosevelt did not actually issue greenbacks. He didn't use all of the policy tools that the Thomas Amendment had given him. But, of course, he was doing other things that would inflate wages and prices, which you could look at just the public works and jobs programs of the New Deal, putting millions of people to work. That's inflationary in a good sense. It's putting people to work. It's increasing consumer purchasing power and demand. Of course, it begs the question, how is the federal government going to pay for those public works and jobs programs? They didn't do it with greenbacks, but they did it through a number of other very innovative and novel ways, through a public bank of sorts that was called the Reconstruction Finance Corporation, and through the Federal Reserve itself, which today the Fed essentially has confined its lending to the financial sector, but during the 1930s and 1940s, the Fed was making loans directly to business enterprises and infrastructure kinds of investments and loans.
Tim, I'd like to get into the question of what more the Fed can be doing, both in terms of direct lending to public enterprises and to businesses and perhaps to infrastructure banks. But there's also a question that has come up very recently with regard to the debt ceiling specifically, and it has to do with the issuance of a coin in the amount of $1 trillion, a platinum coin, which wouldn't have to be agreed to by Congress, which could pay some of the debt. Do you want to talk a bit about that?
Sure. The so-called platinum option And the reason it wouldn't have to be agreed to by Congress is that Congress, the law is already on the books. Congress long ago authorized the Treasury Department to mint platinum coins and gave the Treasury Secretary the discretionary authority to mint these coins and the authority to declare the coins of any value. So we're way past the day when you pick up a coin, let's say a 50-cent piece, a dollar coin, and it would have a dollar's worth of gold in that dollar coin. And it's the same idea with platinum. So just on a purely legal perspective, does the Secretary of the Treasury have this authority? It seems quite clear to me and to many others that, in fact, the Treasury Secretary would have the authority to mint a platinum coin. It could be the size of a dime, the size of a quarter. The Treasury Secretary could declare that this coin has a value of $1 trillion and then deposit that coin in the Treasury Department's account with the Federal Reserve, and it could then have $1 trillion that it would use presumably to buy up its own bonds and reduce the outstanding of level of Treasury debt, thereby taking a step back from the debt ceiling limit by $1 trillion.
Tim, let me ask you from a very sophomoric point of view here. I mean, effectively, that, for lack of a better way of framing it, it's a legal fiction. So we can do whatever the hell we want is kind of what you're saying. But if there's nothing, if the economy itself structurally isn't backing up, so let's say we print the money or you come up with your $1 trillion coin or whatever, and you use it to cancel the debt, if you will. And that's really, it's just all made up. It's Alice in Wonderland, it's et cetera. But if the economy isn't on solid footing and the productivity of the economy isn't sufficient, what does that really mean as a theory or as a way of trying to spend down the debt? I mean,
well, I think you're asking a very important question. And when I say when we talk about the platinum option, this platinum coin, it's very similar to a greenback. It's just that it's a greenback in the form of a coin. Look, if Lincoln had printed up, I think in total it was about $450 million of greenbacks, which back then was a tremendous amount of money, and had not spent it wisely, you could say there could be a lot of bad consequences that could flow from it. If you print up a platinum coin of $1 trillion and just hand out the money, I suppose that's sort of like monopoly money, and perhaps it's going to be inflationary. It's not tied to any real economic activity. I think there have been proposals that are very interesting, the greenback proposals, where the money would be issued and spent in ways that does increase the productivity, the production, the capacity of the American economy. So let me just give you one example. In 1999, a congressman, a Republican congressman from Illinois, introduced a bill that would have had the Treasury Department make $360 billion in interest-free loans to state and local governments over a five-year period. So that's about $72 billion a year for 5 years. Now, what state and local government wouldn't want an interest-free loan? And the interest-free loans were supposed to be tied to capital investments, to infrastructure projects, which, you know, an infrastructure project takes a long time to create, to work on, but it should result in, you could say, a collective asset that could last 30, 40, 50 years. Bridges, tunnels, sewage treatment facilities, the kinds of projects that will certainly add to the productive capacity of the society for generations to come. And the novelty of that proposal was that Treasury would not be borrowing the funds. Treasury would be issuing credits in United States notes. So essentially the greenback, maybe in an electronic form. And therefore, it would not cost the Treasury a penny to be making these investments or facilitating the investments by state and local governments. And you could say that it should actually be reducing deficits at all levels of government, state, local, and federal, because as these infrastructure projects would rev up, that $360 billion, that's probably a few million people who would find work on these infrastructure projects. You start restoring the tax base. People who are not working are suddenly have the resources, the capacity to pay all kinds of taxes, not just income taxes, but sales taxes and property taxes. So it could actually be reducing deficits. That proposal was made by a congressman at the time named Ray LaHood. And LaHood, that Republican, is now the transportation secretary for Obama and has been since the beginning of Obama's first term. I should say that the LaHood proposal of 1999 got a couple of dozen co-sponsors from across the spectrum, Dennis Kucinich on the left and some conservative Republicans on the right. It's those kinds of solutions that we really should be talking about, particularly now when there's all of this hysteria about budget deficits. And that hysteria is occurring at a time when the infrastructure is just crumbling. It's aging, it's not effective, and it needs to start being replaced. This generation was really born in the lap of luxury with probably the greatest infrastructure that any generation has ever, you know, found itself born into. And yet it's being run down, it's not being replaced, it's not being repaired. And, you know, we're always just a crisis away, whether it's a bridge that falls into the Mississippi or a bad earthquake or hurricane. There's plenty of need for this type of infrastructure investment. In fact, the American Society of Civil Engineers just a few years ago said that we had an infrastructure deficit that was something like $1 or $2 trillion. I can't remember, but it was a rather large figure of money that needs to be invested just to keep current with our infrastructure needs.
Tim, I wanted to bring up again what you had alluded to before, which regard to, and we don't have too much time to talk about this, but I do think it's very important, your proposals with regard to the use of the Federal Reserve Bank, which they have not been doing, which was, they did do some of this in the 1930s to directly fund infrastructure and infrastructure mm-hmm. banks.
It's an interesting history. It started in 1932 with a transportation bill that was passed in the final year of the Hoover administration that had a provision that allowed, authorized the Federal Reserve to make loans to private industries, to, I think they said, to corporations, individuals, and partnerships. Essentially, the non-banking, non-financial sector could get Federal Reserve loans. It's opening up the Fed's discount window for Main Street, you could say. Now, the caveat of the 1932 legislation was that I believe it could only be used under, you know, exigent emergency types of circumstances, and the borrower had to put up for as collateral Treasury securities, very good collateral. A year later, when Roosevelt took office in 1933, a new act expanded the Fed's lending capacity, and then even 1 year later in 1934, you got what was called Section 13B of the Federal Reserve Act that really removed a lot of the restrictions that, that had hampered the Fed in these loans. And the Fed went on and was authorized to make, I believe, $280 million of these industrial loans. And at its peak, it was making about $125 million each year in these industrial loans. It probably would have made even more, but as I had mentioned earlier, the Reconstruction Finance Corporation, a public sector bank / revolving fund, was really the go-to financing quite often And when the Reconstruction Finance Corporation wasn't meeting a need, that's when the Fed would come in with these industrial loans. So it's very interesting to see the kinds of projects that both the Fed and the Reconstruction Finance Corporation were funding during the 30s and 40s. By the 1940s, you get the Reconstruction Finance Corporation funding the creation of vast industrial factories in the petrochemical industry as part of the wartime effort. So, you know, when you hear, unfortunately, I've heard it too much coming from the Democrats in the past few years, where you don't expect this kind of thinking to come from, but President Obama, his former chief economic advisor, Austin Goolsbee, time and again, I heard them say the public sector cannot create jobs, only the private sector can create jobs. And, it's just not true when you look at American history that there's an awful lot of economic development that took place in the public sector with public jobs and with financing through public financing institutions. Really, a parallel public banking system was created during the 1930s and 1940s in particular.
I just want to jump way ahead in the time. Is there even a basis for being as hysterical as the mass media whips us into, pursuant to the discourse by both parties on the issue of the debt? After all, we could run very nicely without paying down the debt, could we not?
You're absolutely right. When you look at the size of the deficit right now, the federal deficit is approximately 8% of gross domestic product. Greece, I think, maxed out at about 10 or 11 or 12% of gross domestic product. And why was that a problem? It was a problem because Moody's and Standard & Poor's, the credit rating agencies, said it was a problem. It was a problem because the bond vigilantes, the investment banks, the banks that speculate on currencies and bonds made it a problem. And when you look at it historically, these figures are not that terribly high. During the 1940s, you had the federal deficit in the United States at a level that was more than three times as big as it is today. It was over 30% of GDP. And the roof didn't cave in on the American economy. In fact, they were years where the American economy made the kinds of investments that would make it the premier economy in the world. So I think there is an awful lot of hysteria. I think the deficits would come down as we put people back to work. There's still officially something like 12 million Americans out of work, and probably another 10 million who have fallen through the cracks, who we call discouraged workers or part-time workers who are looking for full-time work. You know, that's an awful lot of a big percentage of the population that if we were able to get the economy working again and get the population working again, there'd be a lot more tax revenue that would start flowing in, and I don't think we would have the kinds of deficit problems that we're told we have today. But I must say that I blame Obama as much as the Republicans for this turn in the discourse. It's interesting when you look back to January of 2010. This is before the Tea Party victories of November 2010, when the Democrats controlled the House and the Senate and the White House. There was a Republican bill introduced in the Senate to create a deficit commission to study the deficit, and it failed in the Senate, and in fact, about half a dozen of the Republican co-sponsors voted against it, including John McCain. Mitch McConnell, the Senate minority leader, voted against it. 2 weeks after that provision, that proposal went down in defeat in the Senate, Obama created the deficit commission by an executive order. I don't know how you can explain that. So he himself probably did more to shift the agenda from stimulus to austerity just by creating this deficit commission. And then he made it worse. Who does he put to be the co-chairs of the commission? Alan Simpson, a conservative Republican who had been talking, you know, crying wolf about the deficit for years. And Erskine Bowles, another deficit hawk, a Democrat who was on the board of directors of Morgan Stanley. It's not as if Obama put Joseph Stiglitz or Paul Krugman or, you know, people with different perspectives who could say, wait, let's reduce the deficit, but reduce it by putting people to work.
Well,
try to reduce it by throwing people out of work.
And I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there.
We have a deficit.
Professor Timothy Canova, thank you so much for joining us. We'll continue to look at these issues.
Thank you.
And for the discussion of the greenbacks and perhaps using them, so to speak, as a way of financing or spending down the debt today. This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.